took me right into college. I still have all my hardware and software, as well as all the basic programs, games, and useless little demos I made. Looking forward to more episodes, and welcome to podcasting. Thank you, Nermux. I appreciate it, and I'm sorry I didn't get this in through the last episode. Somehow I missed it, and again, my apologies. And I will be covering Text Wizard sometime soon about the episodes to date. Nothing fancy, but they're interesting nonetheless. This episode will feature VisaCorp VisaCalc. I have a lot of information collected, and hopefully it doesn't get too long. With that, let's get on with it. Like you don't already know, a spreadsheet is a program for organization, analysis, and storage of data in a tabular form. Basically, an electronic simulation of paper accounting worksheets. The data is organized in rows and columns. As data is changed in any cell, calculations for other cells that reference the changed cell automatically get updated. The word spreadsheet came from spread, in its sense of a newspaper or magazine item, text and or graphics, that covers two facing pages, extending across the centerfold and treating the two pages as one large one. The compound word spreadsheet came to mean the format used to present book 18 lines is all you get per page, even if you have 90 quote entries. Did I mention this is episode 10? Woohoo! Menu item D, delete stock and closing quotes from portfolio. Yeah, there's not a whole lot to say here. You need the ticker symbol, obviously. You input it, it's removed, and the updated portfolio is displayed on the screen. Then, when you press return, you are returned to the main menu. Menu item E, graph stock closing quotes. This is the meat and potatoes of the program, and basically what everybody would be interested in. That's right, nice colorful graphs. So the screen here is broken into two parts. The upper part is a graphic display where the actual graph is created, and the bottom part is a four-row text display where it shows your dividend and interest. Now, in the text window, if a value can't be calculated, NMF will be displayed, and that stands for no meaningful data. And in the top part where the graph is, there are room for 120 different days of data. The upper graph is broken into three sections. At the top, you have a six-day oscillator in blue. In the middle, you have the high and low range in black. Also in the middle is a 10-day moving average, which is in red. And at the bottom, you have the volume in black. When you start this item, you'll be asked for the ticker symbol and a start and end date. And again, the dates are optional. After the graph is displayed, you press Enter, then return back to the input screen. The screen color is defaulted back to the standard Atari colors at this point. Returning you to the input section allows you to plot a graph for another stock. So one note for the graphs. With very high volumes, like today's trading volumes, the volume charts will exceed the display, making the chart somewhat useless, since it will be completely black. The program was designed for 1980 trading volumes, and is geared towards volumes in the tens of thousands, but today's trading volumes can easily reach tens of millions. More on this in the limitations segment of the show. And menu item F, exit. This does what you think, it exits to basic. Now I'll talk briefly about the files. Atari Stock Charting came with two disks, program disk and a blank data disk. The program disk has DOS 2.0S, and the data disk is formatted with the same. On the program disk, in addition to the DOS files, there are six other files, which are the programs. The first, Stock, is the directive menu. This is hard-coded to run function programs from D1. The second is STK-DEF-11. This equates to Directive A, Add Stock to Portfolio. The third is STK-TR-19, which equates to Directive B, Enter Quote Data. The fourth, STK-L-7, equates to Directive C, or List Quote Data. The fifth, STK-DEL-4, equates to Directive D, Delete Stock from Portfolio. And number six is STKPL15, which equates to Directive E, graph the stock. After you've created data and stored it on your data disk, there will be two files. The first is portfolio, spelled PRTFOLIO, and the second is symbol. The symbol file isn't actually symbol. It is the ticker symbol for each stock. So there will be multiple files, one for each stock. Now these are ASCII files, and dates in them are converted to 5-digit numbers. For example, 1-13-87 for January 13, 1987 becomes 13527. I didn't bother to decode that, but that's what they do. All the numeric data shows up as numeric data. While I'm talking about files, there are a couple of things I neglected to mention earlier. When you're inputting data, it's saved to the file every 50 entries, and the program monitors the disk utilization, so it will give you a warning when it starts to become full. Now let's talk a little bit about the limitations, the first of which is going to be dates. I already stated this once, but the oldest date you can enter is 1950, and the program is hard-coded to use 1900, so you must use a day-compatible year. For example, 2015, a day-compatible year would be 1987. This is the only way to overcome the date in this particular program, as 1900 is used in calculations in various parts. So by using a day-compatible year, it will at least work.
Addition of new homebrew titles from Episode 7 can only benefit the show. I'll just conclude this email by saying thank you, Rob, for the enormous effort and enthusiasm that you put into Player Missile, and I look forward to downloading Episode 8 in a few weeks. Well, thanks, Justin. Thanks for the note. And it's been more than a couple weeks. Sorry about that. So thanks for your patience. And thanks for the feedback. Over on Atari Age, they just started up High Score Club Series 12. And they just started it, so I encourage you all to check it out. I'm hopefully going to compete in all the games this season. I'm really going to make an effort at it. The first game is Pac-Man Jr. Which is a really good Pac-Man port. It's like a scrolling Pac-Man, so it's, you know, it's wider than the screen. Really, really hard. I submitted a couple scores. I'm solidly in the middle of the bottom half, so I think that's going to be my target area. Yeah, so go check it out, the Atari Age High Score Club for the 8-bit computers. I'll put a link to the latest season in the show notes. More sort of feedback on Twitter, I think. One of the guys on Antic was badmouthing the Android, and I'm an Android user, so I had to defend Android a little bit. So if you listen to the latest Antic episode, will include my little bit on how to install an Atari 8-bit emulator on Android. And, yep, thanks to Randy, Brad, and Devin? What's that guy's name? I forget his name. And finally, in feedback, this is my first podcast since the Potty Awards. So if you have heard about the Atari Age forum thread, two worthy video game podcasts, this was started back in 2009 by Atari Age user S1500. And he subsequently created the Potty Awards in his own podcast, the Classic Console Gamer News. So Player Missile was nominated in the Best New Retro Computing Podcast category, and it was a surprise people choice win. I actually won it. So thanks. That's
for the next 12 years if you start with 1987 for 2015. All right, in Module B, the stock tracking, where you input the stock quotes, there is a limit on the share volume at 99,999, which makes it incapable of supporting today's trading patterns. The good news is there's a relatively easy fix. Make the changes described on the Inverse Ataski website. This will work for volumes up to 99,999,999. Now, if you remember, I said you had to enter in the share volumes in hundreds, which is in essence dividing the volume by 100. So for 53,462,138, you would enter 534,621. Module C, Stock Listing. With the large trading volumes again, there is another fix. Listings will have the date butt up against the volume if the volume is 6 digits, and this is fixed by altering a single line in program STKL7. Again, make the changes described on the Inverse Ataski website. This will, in essence, move that first column over by one, allowing a space to be inserted so that the data doesn't butt up against each other.
Nice butt!
Module E, Graphing. Trying to graph with today's trading volume results in a large black box because the values shoot off the chart. There are only 76 y-axis plot points available. I was able to work around the problem by modifying the code yet again. The program plots the share volume across the entire y-axis if needed. This time, I take the share volume and further divide it by 100, then multiply it by 0.0025 so the volume plots appear in the lowest part of the graph's y-axis. So that's it for the limitations, and to go along with them, I fixed the boot logo and added a credit to the splash screen. These changes are documented on the InverseAtascii website, and I've also included a copy of this program for archiving. So both the original version and my updated version should be available.
Summary.
This is one of the better programs I've seen that's been written in BASIC. The errors are handled well, but just don't press break. Again, I'm not sure why Atari didn't trap that. Seems like a fairly simple thing to do. But overall, it does what it sets out to do, and it does it fairly well. Ah, the dreaded complaints. First, when entering date ranges in Module B, or Menu Item B, you must have a start date that matches at least one record, or else no records are displayed. No match is required for the end date, however. So this makes it hard to see all entries for a given range unless you know at least one entry in the range that you want to see. This doesn't happen in Module E, which is the graphing module. 2. You have to enter quote data in chronological order, so you can't enter older data should you decide to. 3. I found absolutely no way to edit or remove invalid daily quote data. If you notice a mistake, you must go back to B and re-enter it per the manual, but I could never figure out exactly how to make that work. And what did I really like about it? Well, there wasn't a whole lot that came out and grabbed me, but it was pretty easy to use, and the graphs did look pretty nice once I got them to work correctly. So I jumped in the Wayback Machine, and it's 1980. Would I use this? Sure, I would use it. In 1980, there were no others. From a retro perspective, would I use it? Maybe. In the absence of other stock charting software, this does what it sets out to do, so it would be useful. If there is one with better editing capabilities, I would choose that instead, though. If you are truly only using a vintage computer, then you won't mind keying the data in daily or weekly. If you are multi-platforming, however, you may want to export the data and import it, but there's no way to import or even download quotes with Atari stock charting. Bummer. What year did CSV become common? I'll have to look that up. Overall, I'm going to give this a bit rating of 6, mainly due to the editing abilities, or lack thereof.
Fun facts.
Okay, here are some interesting facts. Number 1. Section 7 of the manual reads as a disclaimer, stating that the program should not be used as an investment guide, urging you to interpret its results. Number 2. There is a listing of investment services in the back of the manual. Number 3. Included with the program disk is an
Pilot, COBOL, Fortran, Basic, Assembler, Pascal. The little robot guy in the front cover is kind of reminiscent of something you might see on Futurama, but obviously way ahead of its time. There's an ad early on for, on page 4 for Compute's first book of Atari, which I can't remember if I had the first book of Atari. I'll have to go back and look. I think I know I had a couple of these Compute books, and one of the listeners of the podcast, Michael Portuisi, has a couple articles published in some subsequent Compute books, so we'll definitely be looking at these books as they come up. Haven't figured out exactly when I'm going to fit them in the podcast, but I definitely am going to start talking about some of these books. There's an editorial by Lee Pappas, and I heard Kevin Savitz say that he's got an upcoming interview with Lee Pappas in the Antic interviews, so looking forward to hearing that. And basically, the first part of the editorial talks about how they've been sort of falling behind in the publishing dates, and that they're going to stop using months on their
disk, which I've already mentioned. And number 4, also included, is a sheet of disk labels and write protect tabs.
Listener feedback.
Okay, now I have some feedback, some news, and an announcement. not necessarily in that order. We'll start with the announcement. Inversitaski now has 50 followers on Twitter.
Excellent!
Now there are two items of news I want to discuss. The first is a notice from Bill Kendrick, and if you don't already know, the Atari Party 2015 is being held on May 2nd from noon to 5 p.m. The venue is the Yolo County Public Library, the Mary L. Stevens Davis Branch in Davis, California. Bill Kendrick has done a great job organizing this in the past, and I'm sure he'll be doing it again this year. If you are in the area on that date, do stop by, or better yet, plan a trip if you can swing it. For more information, see the official webpage at newbreedsoftware.com/AtariParty/2015. It sounds like a lot of fun, and I wish I could make it there, but unfortunately I cannot due to the next piece of news. VCF Southeast 3.0, or Vintage Computer Festival Southeast 3.0, is being held in Roswell, Georgia, on Saturday and Sunday, May 2nd and 3rd, at the King's Market Shopping Center. I will be at this one. This festival features over 35,000 square feet of displays and exhibits and interactive entertainment. And of note, this year, the PDP-8 turns 50, the Altair 8800 turns 40, and the Amiga 1000 turns 30. There'll be celebrations of each. And again, if you're in the area, stop by and check it out. Or plan a trip there, because I'm sure it'll be fun for everybody. For more information on this show, visit vcfse.org. And last but not least, feedback from listeners. I received an email from Alan, one of the curators at Atari Mania. Alan says, "Just about finished listening to the Family Finances podcast. Great job, I love it. I spend most of my free time scanning and archiving as much Atari 8-bit software as I can, so I don't usually stop to really look at individual programs. Your podcast makes it a lot easier to discover more of this great software, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Please keep up your fantastic work, Alan." While I'm not sure my work is fantastic, I do appreciate the email, and thanks for writing in. And I'm also glad that you're enjoying the podcast.
Special thanks.
I'd like to thank WizWars for distributing the chiptune 8-bit Raceway in such a fashion and with such a license to allow the inclusion in this podcast as part of the intro. I'd also like to thank all the listeners for continuing to listen to me rant about old software that really has no meaning anymore, and all the support on Facebook and Twitter that I'm getting as well. Thank you all. And if you haven't taken the time, please go out to iTunes and give me a rating, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent. It will help other people with similar interest as your own find me.
Contact information.
The show notes can be found on inverseataski.info. It can be found on iTunes using the search term Ataski or Atari. It can be found on Facebook at facebook.com/inverseataski, and you can also follow on Twitter with @inverseataski. To leave comments or suggestions, you can email wade@inverseataski.info or inverseataski@icloud.com. And Inverseataski can also be found on Stitcher. As always, thanks for listening, and stay tuned for the next episode. Progmatic. We'll go with Progmatic. If you're using multi-platforming, huh?
Goodbye.
Welcome to Player Missile, a retrospective of the Atari 8-bit home computer systems, the magazines that covered them, and a somewhat chronological review of games as they arrived on the platform. I'm Rob McMullen.
Needs that version. Computari is a company that is no longer around. I'm not sure when it went out of business, but the trademark was abandoned in July of 1984. And you can visit the website for some ads for a financial wizard.
technical data.
A Financial Wizard was published twice, in 1982 and again in 1984. Both versions were 1.5. The publisher was Online Computer Centers of Oklahoma City. The developer was Computari. I don't know who the programmers were. It was distributed on disk. It required 24K of memory and the basic cartridge. Optionally, you could use a second disk drive. The price was $49.95 in January of 1982.
Disk, it would like scroll off and be hard to see. You'd have to stop the screen as displayed. And so being able to print out to a printer would be convenient. And there's an article about condensing data statements on the Atari, so it replaces integer data with the equivalent ASCII strings. There's a little basic program to simulate an alarm clock using the real-time clock of the Atari. And there's a review of Stud Poker by Dynacomp. In the new products section of the magazine, there's a column titled Atari Launches Major Software Acquisition Program, which is basically talking about the creation of APX. So the lead is, a major new effort to expand the library of consumer-oriented software for its personal computer systems is being launched by Atari Inc. Atari is looking for high-quality programs that can be used immediately, easily, and by people with little or no training in the use of computers. There's a quote by some nameless Atari person that says, we want to acquire software in the areas of personal finance, self-improvement, education, and home entertainment. We are encouraging the creation of software authors. And it goes on to say that the...
And on the second release in February of 1984, the price had increased to $59.95. Now, in today's dollars, the 1982 price would be equivalent to $123.84, and the 1984 cost in today's dollars would be $137.92. I was unable to locate a copy, so I can't tell you anything about the manual.
Usage notes.
Before I get too involved in this, first give you a few facts about the program. You can store 100 checks per month, or 220 if you use two drives. It supports 26 major expense categories and 36 sub-expense categories. In the single drive configuration, it's designed to store all the data on the program disk, though with careful swapping, you can store it on a separate disk. In the two drive scenario, the data is stored on the second disk. All right, let's boot it up and see what it does. Ooh, nice graphic. So what you just heard was the menu. Every time the menu loads, you get that nice little robotic sound. The main menu has 9 basic functions. You have check entry, budget entry, check search, tabulations, bar graph, check balancer, check writer, utilities, and quit. We'll cover each here. One of the things I did to utilize this program was to create a mock budget. And I tried to integrate some real-world transactions into it to make it feel real, even though the money numbers are not actually legitimate. Module 1, Check Entry. This module is used for entering your transactions, which could be checks or they could be deposits. The first thing you notice with Check Entry is that the screen is money-colored green. The screen is divided up into a few sections. The top section has a list of all the expense categories. The middle section has the prompt for what field you are entering. And the bottom section has all the pertinent fields for a check, like the month, the day, the check number, your payee, the expense category, the subcategory, and the amount. And at the very bottom, it shows you what your current checkbook balance is. Check numbers are limited to 4 digits. Normally, I would say this is okay, but today, we don't use a lot of checks, or some of us don't. So if you enter in things like ATM or debit, you'll run into a problem searching later because the program is relying on the check number being unique. And of course, if you enter ATM, then that's not unique if you're doing that on many transactions. The payee field is limited to 11 characters, which I find is a little bit short. A few more characters would have been nice, but you can make do with it. And the amount field is limited to 5 whole numbers and 2 decimals. After you've entered in the last field, which is amount, you press start to accept the record, or you can keep editing the other fields and then press start when you're done. When you get to the next record, the month and the day will be retained, and the focus will be on the day. And you just press escape to exit. When you do that, you'll be asked to enter a new month or to go back to the main menu. So if it's right after the first of the month, then you're entering checks for the end of the month and a new month, and you're doing it out of order, you may have to bounce back and forth between this screen just to change the month number. Item 2, budget entry. The budget entry screen is sort of a confusing interface. At the top of it, you have all the different categories for your budget. And then the middle section, you have where you actually input the data, and the bottom section is mainly instructions. The confusing part is that you start off and you have to enter
microprocessor background preferred, writing and artistic talents, plus systems analysis and specifications development background would be ideal. Degree or equivalent required. Looking for software project management engineers, communication software developers, and then it says, Atari provides you the ultimate state-of-the-art environment complemented by exceptional salaries and benefits, which include company-paid employee leave / health / disability / dental insurance, plus a sabbatical leave policy which offers 7 weeks paid leave of absence after 7 years continuous service with Atari. Yeah, that's not likely to happen. Talk about an empty promise, huh? Please send your resume, including salary history, or contact our employment department, or circle 114 on the reader service card. After that, there's an ad by Microsoft for something called the Soft Card, which is a Z80 card for the Apple II to run CPM on your Apple II. And there were ways to run CPM on the Atari, and I can't remember off the top of my head, but I think there's an expansion module that worked kind of like the 850. I don't remember. There's an article on the Office of
Income first, so you have to select the month, and then you'll put in the salary. And then you will go through and pick your expense categories, and then you put in the amount for each one. Now, if you want an expense category to span all 12 months, then you would follow the amount with a forward slash. To change months while you're entering your budget, you have to use the greater than key, and that will ask you for the new month. And to quit this one, you use the asterisk key. So what you're going to notice right away is that there is no consistency between the modules when exiting or changing months. Menu item 3, check search. The check search input form is divided into two different sections. The top section shows you all the different expense categories, and the bottom section are the fields that you can search on. And the search is pretty robust. The screen is red, and you're allowed to search on payee, expense category, subcategory, check number or a range of checks, a month or a range of months, a day or a range of days, and an amount or an arrange of amounts. Now, you can specify to send the output to a printer as well, which will dump a copy of what's displayed on the screen at its completion. When it displays the items on the screen, if there are more items than will fit, they will scroll off the top as new ones are added to the bottom. If you look at the search results screenshot on the website, you'll see the check numbers that I devised to try and make them unique, where I used a letter and then two digits which represented the day and then the first letter of the place where I was making a purchase. But that method really is kind of confusing, and it didn't work out too well because you still end up with some that are not unique. Menu item 4, tabulations. This item generates a couple of different reports, the first of which is expenses compared to budget by month, and the second is expenses compared to budget by category. So you'll need to enter the month here, and if you're generating the category report, you'll also need to enter the category. That was the sound of the tabulations display being created. Once the display is generated, you can press P to get a hard copy printout, or press M to go back to the tabulations menu. If you do print, you go back to the tabulations menu automatically when it's done. Menu item 5, bar graph. This lets you chart 1 month's expenses for all categories, or one category's expenses over 12 months. First you choose the graph you want, then you choose your type of printer. It's then displayed to the screen and dumped to the printer. After the dump to the printer is complete, the screen is modified to say press any key to continue at the top. You do that and you return to the bar chart menu. The charts it creates are basically black and white charts, and the category only one is much easier to read than the expenses for all categories. And again, you can find samples of the screenshots and printouts on the website. Menu item 6, Check Balancer. This does what you think and helps you balance your checkbook. You start by entering the statement ending balance. This threw me at first because I couldn't enter a statement starting balance, so it assumes that everything is balanced at the beginning. Next, you enter the month number, and then you actually start doing the reconciliation. Now, it has some awkward controls because you use D and U to navigate up and down instead of the arrow keys. You press asterisk to clear a check, and then the cursor will move down automatically. Press Q when all the checks have been cleared. Once you're done, it will process the data and give you a summary showing any difference in outstanding entries. If it doesn't balance or doesn't come back to zero, you get an explosion sound and the message, "Nice try." If it does balance, you get the message, "By Jove, the financial wizard did it," and a short song plays. Either way, you press 1 for the main menu, 2 for the check balancer menu, or 3 to print a copy. Menu item 7, Check Writer. This allows you to print checks on pre-formatted stock. You first need to enter the date as the month, the day, and a year, and it has to be in the 1900s. It will not work past 1999. You can't use a day-compatible year, like 1987 for 2015, to get around this, because if you did, the checks would be printed with the year 1987 and would be no good. Due to the date limitation, I couldn't produce a valid output for you to look at, but I could walk the screens as it worked, finding zero matches. Menu item 8, Utilities. The utility menu has 8 different options. First is Audit Your Checkbook. Second is Create Monthly Files. Third is Change Expense Categories. Fourth is Clear Expense Files. Fifth is Clear Budget Files. Sixth is Correct Expense Files. Seventh is End of Year Outstanding Check Transfer to a New Year's Disk. Or the last one, which is Zero, which is Return to Main Menu. The Utilities menu is full of some annoying sounds, such as the one you just heard. Number 1, Audit Your Checkbook. This shows the current and beginning of year balance, and while it's running through its calculations, it has a nifty spinning plus sign. It displays 12 months of deposits and expenses, and each month's ending balance. When it's done, you can press Option to get a hard copy. Utility item 2, Create Monthly Files. Are you sure? That tone is continuous until you decide that you really want to do this. So what this item does is help you create your monthly data disks. First, you need to decide if you're going to use one drive and one disk for 100 transactions per month, or two drives and two disks for 220 transactions per month. Now, choose wisely, because after you set it, you can't change it. When using two drives, your data disk will always be in drive 2. It's going to ask you if the disk is formatted, and you must do it rather than let the program do it. Then it's going to ask you about 4 files being transferred from the master disk to this new data disk. If they're not there, you have to exit and do it yourself, then come back. It will not do it for you. So be prepared, have your disk formatted, and have the 4 files copied onto it before you execute this function. If all is good, it'll create the files by month on disk and then return you to the menu. Utilities item 3, Change Expense Categories. This lets you change the descriptions of each of the expense categories. Items A through U are expense categories, V is an income category, and W through Z are for record keeping. I don't know what the W through Z were actually used for because I don't have the manual. This uses a freeform editor. You move around the screen with the arrow keys, changing the text you want. You press return when you're done to acknowledge that everything has changed. And when you do so, if you pay very close attention, you'll see this program walk through the screen grabbing your input. Utility item 4, clear expense files. So here you get the warning tone again until you acknowledge what you're doing by pressing Ctrl-C to proceed. So because this is a destructive function, which is going to wipe out all your expense data on the current disk, you also have to type in yes before it actually does anything. Utility item 5, clear budget files. So yeah, you get the warning tone again until you press Ctrl-C to proceed. And again, because this is going to destroy all the budget data on your disks, you also have to type in yes to acknowledge it. Utility item 6, correct expense files. Without the manual and without instruction on screen, I don't know what exactly this does. I suspect it may remove deleted entries and compact the files on the disk.
And he's got his own personal website that has a whole bunch of stuff, you know, source code and everything, so that's worth checking out. So from the James Hague interview, he asked Chris Crawford, so Eastern Front was a state-of-the-art war game at the time. What deficiencies of contemporary games were you trying to overcome? And Chris Crawford said, two, poor user interface and poor artificial intelligence. He said the AI was particularly clever. All the user I.O. was taken care of during vertical blank processing. And the AI was done during the mainline processing using a system of convergent approximations. So it said the AI started off with a stupid move and then kept examining improvements on it. And he said you could take as long as you want to plan your own move, but every second you took to plan, the computer got another million cycles to refine its own move. Another question James Hague asked was, why was Eastern Front released through Atari, through APX rather than the official Atari label? And then he replied, because the Atari marketing people thought a war game would never sell. So clearly that changed because they released it on cartridge the next year.
The only thing that you're asked is which month you want to work with, or you can press asterisk to quit. Once you enter a month, you'll see it correcting that month with asterisks going across the screen while it works. Utility item 7, end of year outstanding check transfer to New Year's disk. You use this at the end of the year to transfer your outstanding checks to a new month. This lets you keep the previous 12 months worth of disks without having to overwrite them all the time, thus giving you your history. Utility menu item 0, return to main menu. Do we really need to talk about that? And last, main menu item 9, quit. Again, I'm not going to talk about that. That pretty much wraps up the program features. Now I want to talk about the files for a minute. I always like poking around data files to see what's in them, and this program was no exception. So there are 16 different files on the data disk. The first I want to talk about is the BAL file, or BAL. This has your account balance information. It's in ASCII format, so you can read it. The next file is budget.dat, and this has your budget information in it. And it is pretty much all binary, although there are some bits that you can read. The next is cktote.dat, which is your checking total, I presume. It's all binary. And then you have expcat.dat, which is expense categories, and it's all ASCII. And then the last 12 files are your monthly checking data, and they are checkdat.m1 through 12. And those are all ASCII files as well, so you can read them.
Fun facts.
First, you could purchase a 10-disc holder, which was clear plastic, for an additional $4 at time of purchase. But as advertised, it only holds Financial Wizard discs, so don't try and mix anything else in there. Second, it was sold exclusively through online computer centers in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Third, there was a $10 upgrade from Personal Finance if you sent the original disc back in.
summary.
Overall, this was not a bad program. It was nice being able to work with two disk drives and not have to swap disks, and it worked pretty quickly for everything that it did. The search was also a huge bonus because it was very flexible and allowed you to find pretty much anything you wanted. Really, the only downside is that it's not Y2K compliant. Some of the print functions and some calculations require 20th century dates, 1900 to 1999. You can use a day comparable year, such as 1987 for 2015, but when you write checks, it'll show 1987, and of course you wouldn't be able to cash it. So I guess on to complaints. First up, there's no browsing, and I've already said this numerous times, I really can't stand not having navigation when you're looking at database type data. On top of that, I had a hard time with edits. The awkward combination of select plus option was very difficult through emulation. Next up is search. While it does provide a lot of flexibility in finding records, once it returns its results, it doesn't let you edit or delete directly from there. Next, there's no direct method of printing, so you have to use search to find the items and then print. And last, the custom keyboard input routine was sometimes slow and generally missed characters if you tried to type too fast. So I guess that list wasn't really too bad, especially considering one of them was my issue because I was trying to do this through emulation and not on the real hardware. But there are a lot of things I did like about it. Several programs on the ST. One was a database of sorts to help me track vehicle mileage. Another was a Dungeons & Dragons character generator, a program that I would write repeatedly on many computers starting on the Atari 8-bits. Yeah, I played D&D back then. It's a whole lot of fun, and it's Will Wheaton approved. So if you've never played a fantasy role-playing game, I encourage you to do so. It's a great escape, and like I said, it's a lot of fun. It was also during this time I learned about desktop publishing programs. Though it's not technically desktop publishing software, I used rubber stamp on the Atari ST to make a lot of different forms and posters. Around 1988, I had sold pretty much all of my Atari collection, including my ST, which left me to use the IBM PCs at work and storing my data on 5 1/4-inch floppies, which I kept in the glove box of my car for the most part. Not ideal. At work, I got to learn about professional-grade word processors like WordStar and WordPerfect, networking with Novell NetWare, CAD or computer-aided drafting using AutoCAD, advanced typesetting using PageMaker, spreadsheets with Lotus 1-2-3, and a quote-unquote real database using Ashton Tate's DBase. I was amazed at what could be achieved with a computer and the proper software. DBase quickly became one of my favorites, and I ended up programming in it for a long period of time. Back then, I would spend hours looking through software for what it does and how it might benefit me, something I still do to this day. There was a period of a few years from 95 or 96 and ending in 1998 or 99 where I had reacquired some Atari computer equipment. I had an Atari 1040 ST coupled with a SciQuest zip drive and a Hayes 2400 baud modem. I did everything on that machine, including surf the web, albeit web surfing was a bit of a dismal experience. Well, that's enough, or actually too much, about me. Now a little bit more about the show. Sorry. While I did and do enjoy video games on the 8-bit, I have always been interested in what the computer could do for me to make life easier, more productive, or just more efficient. This show is the inverse of the other Atari shows. No games here. Only things that enable personal productivity. That said, I do enjoy the other Atari shows immensely. They are what sparked this idea. I'm going to break the show down into seasons. The first season will cover word processing. Further seasons will cover databases, spreadsheets, finance, and education software. We'll see where it goes from there. I just have over a dozen shows for season one, which may change if I find something that should be added. My goal is to produce a show every 3 weeks. If I can do it faster, I will, but 2 weeks will probably be the maximum frequency due to other constraints on time. This is my first podcast ever, so bear with me as I get acclimated to hosting. I hope you find it interesting and continue to listen. If you have any corrections or suggested additions, please feel free to let me know.
Special thanks.
I'd like to thank Ferg from the Atari 2600 Game by Game podcast for giving me the initial inspiration to do this and answering many, many questions for me. I'd also like to thank Rob O'Hara from You Don't Know FLAC podcast for his excellent episode on podcasting, which I've listened to several times taking careful notes in hopes of making this one decent. So thank you, Baker and Commodork. You can find Inverse Atascii on Facebook at http://www.facebook.com/InverseAtascii, on Twitter at InverseAtascii, and on the web at http://inverseatascii.info. You can reach me via email with wade@inverseatascii.info or inverseatascii@icloud.com. Again, thanks for listening, and I hope you'll tune back in.
Goodbye. I'm going to focus on games and magazines for the systems. Antic was the first podcast that I listened to. And when I first started listening, they were on episode 5 or something. And I burned through their episodes pretty quickly and wanted more. Through them, I discovered No Quarter with Mike McGinnis and Carrington Vanston, which is a great podcast about classic arcade games. Mostly the era before, like, 1990, which is right up my alley. And I burned through all those. And through them, I learned of You Don't Know FLAC by Rob O'Hara, which is about a lot of things, but mostly retro computing. And he's a Commodore 64 guy, and that's okay. You know, we're all friends here. It's a safe space. But specifically, he did an episode about podcasting, a podcast about podcasting. The big takeaway I got from that was that doing your own podcast was possible. You didn't need a ton of equipment, just an idea. So he got other podcasters to share their thoughts, and the common theme was, do the podcast you wish someone else was doing. So here it is. This is the podcast I wish someone else was doing. So my shtick is going to be attempting to chronologically cover important or significant games for the 8-bit, or for some definition of important or significant. But the reason I want to look at games mostly chronologically is that I think it would be interesting to see how developers expanded the capabilities of the platform as time went on. The problem really is the sort of granularity of the release dates seems to be lost to time. All the Atari 8-bit game archives that I'm using, like Atari Mania and Atari 8-bit Forever, they only list publication year and not month. So I'm going to try to use references I find in magazines in order to find release dates with sort of a better precision. You know, and maybe this approach will be useful, and maybe it won't. Maybe there won't be enough reviews or references to figure out where or what came before what. I may have to abandon that approach at some point. But it's a lot of maybes. But for now, it gives me an excuse to discuss the old retro magazines as well, which is just a blast. You know, maybe there's another way to do it. Maybe my Google Foo isn't strong enough to turn up anything, any references with more details. Maybe you, the listener, have some ideas about it. And if so, I'd love to hear it. So if you found this podcast and weren't an Atari owner, that is totally awesome. I will be including hopefully enough background info for a fan of any classic system to be interested. Also, if you weren't an Atari owner, and you don't know what the title of this podcast refers to, it's the Atari term for sprite graphics. And sprite graphics are like the hardware-assisted two-dimensional drawing routines that, in the case of the Atari, had collision detection built in. I'll get into some more of the technical details in the next episode. So the Atari computers themselves are released in three styles. The original, or sort of the classic design, released in 1979. Then the black and silver XL series was in 1983. And then the gray XE series, sort of styled like the Atari ST, came out in 85. And the XEs remained in production well into the 90s, but by that time, mostly concentrated in Eastern Europe. I love the Atari 8-bits in a way I don't love other systems. You know, for one, it's the first computer, and you always remember your first.